Hey everyone, welcome to our first episode of the Requirements Engineering Podcast. Today we have as one of our interview speakers, Jeffrey Kent, who is an author, speaker, and trainer to the oil and gas industry. He followed an early career with Imperial Oil, then he joined Deloitte, where he carried out several hundred consulting assignments around the world and eventually led a number of businesses, services, and industry programs. Today, Jeffrey specializes in digital innovation, produces a weekly article and podcast on digital issues in energy, and teaches an executive course on digital awareness. He published his first book, Bits, Bytes, and Barrels, The Digital Transformation of Oil and Gas, in January 2019. He is also a contributing author for Machine Learning and Data Science in the Oil and Gas Industry, Best Practices, Tools, and Case Studies, released in March 2021. Jeffrey is also an advisor to several digital technology companies in such areas as artificial intelligence, blockchain, cloud computing, robotics, and Internet of Things. In this interview, we talk about how organizations can design teams for digital transformation and innovation in the oil and gas industries. We also spoke about how organizations can adapt into a hybrid development method, which includes both agile and waterfall development methods. We also deep dive on the top risk management challenges that organizations in the field do face and how to mitigate these risks, including cybersecurity. And we pretty much finalize our conversation deep diving into both the short-term and long-term challenges the industry faces. This is definitely a really interesting conversation. We spoke about many other different topics throughout our conversation with Jeffrey. And I'm sure that you guys will enjoy all this practical knowledge that he pretty much shares throughout the conversation. Please don't forget to subscribe either to our podcast, YouTube channel, and also into our member portal, which you can find at visualsolutions.com/register to watch more of exclusive content like this one. I really hope you guys enjoy this conversation and learnings and can apply all this stuff and really enjoy this conversation as much as we did. All right, Jeffrey, how are you? Thanks for being here at the Requirements Engineering Podcast. Really excited to have you here. I'm not sure if you want to start off by giving us like a quick background from who you are, pretty much what you do, and so the audience can get to know you.
Oh, for sure. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to the podcast. So my background is fairly lengthy. You probably I've shaved off all of my gray hair. There's plenty of it. I first started my career with Imperial Oil in Toronto. So I was working for the oil industry. And that was after getting a degree from McGill University in business administration. Then I was told the oil industry, it's really engineering dominated, and because I'm not trained as an engineer, my pathway in the industry would follow more commercial lines. And so I went back to university to get a master's degree in business. And from there, I joined Deloitte, which is one of the world's largest professional services companies, and stayed there for almost 30 years, working around the world, variety of countries, projects, and various assignments, different organizations. Through all that time, I tried adding them all up. I probably touched 1,000 different projects, everything from the upstream industry, conventional and unconventional. Spent a year with a drilling company, another year with a fracking company. I spent several years working just in retailing fuel downstream. Projects with oil refineries, oil sands plants, lots of, again, most of it commercial as opposed to engineering and hard technology in the industry. And then after I had spent enough time at Deloitte, 30 years, seems like a lot, decided it was time to go do something else. And I left the firm to embark on a completely different career. I wrote two books, both about the impact that digital innovation was going to have on the oil and gas industry globally. And I now use those books as platforms for training courses, as well as lectures and presentations, keynote speeches, which I give to organizations around the world on digital innovation, energy transition, and the directions the energy industry needs to go in order to provide all, you know, for a better future for the citizens of the planet. So that's what I currently do. I also host a weekly podcast where I talk about digital innovation in oil and gas, and I write a weekly newsletter and article on the latest in digital for the industry. So people track me down and follow me for those particular intellectual assets.
Yeah, awesome. So quick question here. So typically when you refer to digital innovation, I mean, something we always talk between, even between me and Jeremy, is that it's a really broad topic. People even use it a lot, yeah, like that term. What specifically do you mean by digital innovation? Can you give us like a quick sum up?
Sure. So the, although I would say I've written books about this, so to distill it down into a very small package is challenging. But digital innovation to me means the introduction of digitally driven ways of working into an enterprise. And that, to me, that there's three elements to that. One is what I call digital foundations. Organizations need to rethink the foundation of their company, everything from its networks, databases, et cetera, to embrace more digital tools that are themselves tied to cloud computing and ubiquitous networks and the like. Second is in companies, digital transformation means embracing a small number of capabilities that in the heavy industry we have not worried too much about, but which other industries have had to deal with much more aggressively. And those include things like big data and information as a resource, the Internet of Things, which generates all kinds of data, artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms, which interpret and translate that data into useful insights, and then robots and autonomy that actually takes the results of those tools and puts them to do real work. And, you know, in manufacturing, you see it in almost fully autonomous factories, as an example. Tesla's cars, fully autonomous vehicle, is just an illustration of that. And the third layer, a third element in digital transformation is ways of working. And this is where requirements is such an interesting angle, because it touches on how work gets done in heavy industry. They typically follow a waterfall method, whereas technology industry is much more trial and error, based on iterative cycles and rapid development cycles. And change management, or adopting things that help people embrace change really quickly, is something the energy industry and heavy industry that's not really worried about. A two-year learning cycle for someone just to learn the basics of a specific job in industry are not unusual. But that doesn't fly in a world where, you know, you pick up an app on a phone, it can start being productive. So digital transformation for me means embracing those three things. The first two, what I call foundations and the capability, you can buy that. And you can do digital if you just buy it or outsource it. But if you want to actually think and be more like a digital organization, you have to really think about how you change your ways of working, and things like how you embrace change and the ways that you do work. And that's what I think of as digital transformation has those three elements in it.
Well, yeah, makes total sense. Can we double click on this part that you were talking about a few minutes ago? Pretty much how teams basically are designed and how work is done. You were basically talking about requirements being of those, one of those angles, and you see, yes, different development methods, waterfall, agile between them. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Sure. I mean, the waterfall method of doing heavy industrial design has been perfected over the years. It's taught in schools. There are tools and methods that drive this. And it is the way that industry, heavy industry, and in that I mean energy companies, oil and gas, railroads, heavy manufacturing, mining, we run these businesses on these very, very prescriptive, typical ways of working. And they yield a very good outcome. when they're followed correctly and well, but they take a very long time and they don't react well to change. So if circumstances change partway through the development of your asset, the waterfall method does not give you a way to go backwards and correct for changes that you might want to embrace. Once your asset construction or your asset delivery has progressed beyond the design stage and gets into construction delivery, it's very expensive to go back and make a repair or a change. That's not how the digital world works. And the digital world works because it's all software. There's no physics and physical world involved with it. It is possible to iterate your way around a change that's coming at you in a fashion that is very hard in heavy industry. And this creates lots of challenges in big industrial companies, because it's not clear when the waterfall method should be the priority, the one you follow, and where you could apply agile or innovative models, iterative models into your design process. And so we have this kind of this shift that we're going through in industry because of this. As one of the interviewees for my book, most recent book, said, you don't use Agile to do a design of a boiler. Like, we've designed all the boilers in the world 50 years ago. You just take that design off the shelf. You adjust it to your specific circumstances. But you don't send to an engineering team, okay, let's organize ourselves in an Agile way and reinvent boilers. Like, that doesn't make sense. But when it comes to the interface between, say, the boiler and the worker, perhaps that's where Agile would be more sensible, where you can iterate around the actual worker and how they engage or interact with boiler mechanics.
Yeah, makes a little sense. And pretty much, what would you recommend, I mean, to the audience here listening, what would you recommend either, like, if they are thinking about going Agile, fully Agile, or probably like staying on a waterfall method? What's your recommendation there?
Well, I'm not sure it is plausible for industrial companies now to say, we do not have to do anything in an agile world. I don't believe that's even possible or practical any longer. The reality is that the falling cost of computer technology means that all kinds of things which we wouldn't otherwise think of being as a digital thing, I'll use my boiler as an example. Our reality now is that we can bolt digital innovation or digital things onto even things like boilers, which normally would be a strictly dumb metal contraption. And so as a result, that digital front end or that digital capability that's bolted onto your physical asset, that's very amenable to digital innovation, digital iterative development. And so the idea that you can do one or the other doesn't work in my view. The world we're going to be in is a hybrid, where some things are going to be waterfall by virtue of the fact that they have hard long lead cycles, or it makes little sense to reinvent them dramatically because of physics or chemistry or real world laws. And then the digital innovations we're going to attach to them or wrap around them. And so we're going to have to figure out the hybrid world. It's not going to be this or that. It's going to be this and that.
Should we say that we see, like, in the industry, like, perhaps, like, softwares being, like, developed, like, with a more agile approach, and everything which is, like, hardware, mechanical, electronic requirements in general, like, being developed, like, with more like a waterfall model? What's your thought on that?
I'm not sure. If you think about 3D printers and the ability to go from a design to a thing that you can touch and feel and inspect and put through tests because you've managed to 3D print it, that's a very accelerated product cycle compared to one where your original the waterfall world would take you. And so even in things like, this using 3D printing, you can accelerate even the design stages of delivery of physical assets.
Yep, makes sense. Now, I want to go back when you were talking a little bit about also like this I mean, one huge challenge on becoming a digital company, the entire part of digital innovation is pretty much like cybersecurity and the entire risk yes. management process around it. Can you please expand like why is cybersecurity like a challenge for this industry, like oil and gas in particular?
Well, cyber is viewed by executives and boards now in every industry as a kind of red line you just don't cross, because the consequences of a cyber attack can be for a heavy industry, for any industry, can be pretty dramatic now. It'd be simply shut down operations. A cyber attack in a power facility, for instance, could put millions of people without power. So cyber is very, very critical issue. So that's the first thing. It sits at the highest level of importance for boards and managers. There are two kinds of cyber challenges that I see. Challenge one is the intentional cyber, you know, guy with a hoodie and he's in his basement and he's hacking away, trying to, you know, figure out how to penetrate your company and steal your stuff. That's one model, intentional cyber activity. And that's a real challenge for companies because state actors get behind it and we don't know who they are, and their purpose can be non-financial, could be just straight up disruption. Hackers in Ukraine right now are trying to disrupt Russia's power industry and oil and gas industry by putting viruses and bugs into Russian oil infrastructure. So that's what I call malicious intentional cyber activity. And then, but in industry, you know, the far bigger challenge is unintentional cyber failure. And that's where someone is not a cyber actor. In other words, they're not intentionally trying to be create a cyber problem. But by virtue of their choices or actions, they become they create a cyber incident. And that cyber incident can have similar ramifications to a hacker breaking into your facility. And so it's little things like that. We have to kind of keep both of these in mind. The one that gets all the press and is very visible is the external cyber problems. That's where we all see it. But the internal cyber challenges, which are not malicious intentionally, but still happen, those are far bigger, more frequent, happen all the time. And so we have these two challenges. And then the third problem with cyber is that the more we roll out digital capabilities into industrial landscape, the greater playground do we create, or is used cyber language, attack surface. We've created more points where people can attack our infrastructure and where problems can arise. So we have a greater playground for cyber activity. And frequently, unfortunately, still, but it's improving all the time. Much of this digital innovation going into our infrastructure does not have the built-in cyber smarts that we now come to expect, given the amount of cyber activity out there. So the industrial entrepreneurs who are building things like Internet of Things are still thinking like cyber doesn't really affect my little innovation, when in fact it should. So we still have far too much of our infrastructure doesn't have any cyber protections at all. So suffice to say, cyber is it's a big problem, and it's lucrative for the crooks. It's ever present for the just in the unintentional side, and the consequences can be very severe. So it continues to be a big deal.
Marcelo, you want to go ahead?
No, go for it, yeah.
Yeah, just like a quick question on that, like how would you advise companies, and especially maybe in the oil and gas industry, to try to mitigate those cybersecurity risks? What could be like any tips, advice? How can they really mitigate that?
Well, there's lots of techniques out there that companies can follow, but a good one is to retain or have someone inside or part of your friendly ecosystem to play the role of an actor, a cyber actor with malicious intent, and give them the assignment to figure out how to attack your digitally enabled industrial infrastructure so that you can identify points of weakness, your vulnerability points, the recovery mechanisms you put into place, your ability to even detect that the attack is going on. That's a very, very useful technique, is to engage a friendly person to assist you in improving the resilience of your infrastructure and your industrial environment. So strongly recommended. Goes by the names ethical hacking, but hacking with purpose, with intent to engage with the counterparty to help them as opposed to oppose them. So that would be one that I would recommend. A second is at the very design level, when you're introducing or doing design work for industrial infrastructure, is that cyber thinking be put in at the beginning. It's kind of like safety in these days. It used to be that if you were doing an industrial design and you didn't think about human safety till you kind of got to the very end, and you went, oh, we've located this valve way up high in the air. We'll have to give a stairway for someone to go up to and see the valve. Let's put a handrail on that and lighting so they can see their way at night and they can hold the handrail on the way up and down. So safety solutions get bolted on after the fact. That doesn't work in cyber. You really want to build that in at the beginning. So it means for design teams, you put cyber professional expertise at the design level so that you can identify where you're going to have some cyber vulnerabilities.
I think that's a good topic, and I think it's interesting as well to mention here. Obviously, I mean, there is like requirement management tools on the markets that can play interesting roles here. I mean, Vizure being one of them, but there are like other on the market, definitely. The way, and I think it's interesting for us to share, like, just on this specific topic, the way we're just releasing like a new template, which is basically, and we're going to have like a lot of more information about like that specific topic. But the way we can answer as well that specific need is by supporting, having like a tool that being able to list all the different cybersecurity risks that the product design team is able to identify, and to be able to, once those risks are basically identified, being able to trace those risks with potentially like safety requirements that would basically mitigate that those risks at the design level. Being able to provide like that full traceability, I mean, obviously tools can play a role, I guess, as well, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. What you're describing, a kind of risk matrix, but with a specific cyber focus, would be a very useful tool to include at the front end of design, because it will absolutely kick out requirements that you'll want to trace all the way through to a commissioned product so that you can understand that cyber impact has been mitigated or you've offset it in some fashion. So yeah, that's another useful tool. That would be, I mean, it would be great to think about putting a, just using something like that, a risk assessment, the front end of a project, is having a cyber professional in the room with the engineers who would point out, well, here's how I would tackle that infrastructure. I'd put a sniffer on that line. I'd be just out at the fence post. I'd have this dish that can interpret your signals. Now what are you going to do? I know your requirement says you don't have to encrypt the data flow coming off of that sensor, but I as a cyber professional, I can tell you I could intercept that signal and do something with it. Maybe encryption should become a requirement. So the little things like that would be very, very handy to build into the design process so that you can make sure that requirement ultimately is delivered.
Makes total sense.
I definitely agree.
Do you think like there's like, besides cybersecurity, other like risk challenges within this digital innovation transition?
Well, there are several that are concerning for industry. Important risk for industrial companies is that the general planning cycle for industry is for a heavy industrial asset is you build it and then it's going to run for 20 or 25 years without change. That's a significant risk now. Building things that don't change for 25 years We're not sure that that's a viable way to do a design now. Designs that are not sufficiently resilient because of climate challenges would be another significant risk area. If you think about the nuclear disaster in Japan, the Fukushima Daiichi reactor on the eastern coast, its risk was the power supply was flooded in the aftermath of the tsunami, and that power supply knocked out power to the reactor. Reactor still has to have an external power supply to keep it running. So the reactor was okay from the tsunami, but the power supply got knocked out. Then the reactor still fell over. So these kinds of risks that we have to be thinking about, not just in digital, but in all kinds of risks now have to be we have to think about them quite differently in these assets, and figure out how do we cope with them and let them change more gracefully over time. I'm reminded of the military. Imagine a fighter jet. You commission a fighter jet from an aircraft manufacturer, and but weapon systems get better over time. Imagine if you had a fighter jet that couldn't have a better weapon system for 20 years. Like, no pilot would want to fly it. Like, if you're going to be a pilot in a fighter jet, you want the latest weapon system, the latest radar. Everything has to be, for over 20 years, we have to keep that aircraft airworthy and safe and productive and on a warlike footing with the latest in weapons. We don't think like that with our other industrial infrastructure. We kind of build it and then we freeze it. So this whole notion of our infrastructure should be steady state for 30 years, we have to confront that challenge and start thinking differently about that. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense now, that we should allow that to happen. So that's, to me, is a very significant business risk we have to now bake into our entire industrial landscape, is how do we keep our industrial assets green for a much longer time than we ever thought possible.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely a problem. Do you have a specific example based on your experience how a company solved it?
I probably can't name names, but there is a new oil facility being constructed in the Gulf Coast area of the United States, where the facility, instead of retaining the usual engineering companies to help with the design, they actually went to a military equipment manufacturer and said, can you assist us building the operational capabilities of this plant, and specifically focusing on SCADA systems, signaling, telecommunications, networking capabilities, data sources, sensors, etc., so that this new oil plant would look more like a jet aircraft that you could swap parts in and out over time. So it's absolutely a consideration, and large companies are staring at this question because they, again, the idea that the asset will stay steady state fixed for 25 years doesn't work. And a good example of where this has fallen over everywhere is that we now know that CO2 and methane are major climate problems for the planet. But the vast majority of our historic oil energy infrastructure was never built to measure carbon, record carbon, capture carbon, put a price tag on carbon, get people to operate the equipment based on a carbon factor. Like, that was not part of the design. And we don't know how to retrofit the equipment to deal with that. And yet now that's precisely what we need to do. And so it's a great example where the failure of thinking like that in the past has now become a significant barrier for us going forward in the future.
Yep. Thanks for that example. All right. So we spoke about some risk challenges. Can we speak now, perhaps some examples of we can go both short-term and long-term challenges, more like in a broad topic. There's definitely, based on our quick research, we came across even environmental challenges, just like many other stuff. Can you expand on those?
Well, environment is a major one. So the broad umbrella that this topic goes under is ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance. And the E, environmental, is actually the most dominant of those three factors in thinking about industrial management. And inside the environment is everything from water and wastewater, air, land impacts, impacts on wildlife, the cumulative impacts, not just my net impact, but the effects of several infrastructures accumulate over time. These are now, all of these factors now have to be taken into consideration in any kind of industrial design setting, so that that facility or that asset is going to be right fit for the very long term. So in the case of the oil industry, just a very simple example, oil and water don't mix, right? They're different viscosities. And so oil industry uses water regularly to move oil around underground. If you put water into an oil reservoir, you can push the oil forward of the water because the oil will float on top of the water. So if you put the oil in on water in on one side under pressure, you can move your oil to, say, where a point where you can recover it. Water is also used in fracking. Water is used in creating steam to heat up reservoirs, to allow you to extract oil. Water is used to separate oil from oil sand in Canada's oil sands, so creates huge settling ponds with water. So it turns out water's really some major issue. There are, I can't remember the number, but millions of truckloads of water in the United States on the road during the year, going between well sites where wells are being completed or fractionated, and off to water disposal sites. So this is a huge environmental challenge now for the industry. It's very costly. Plus, people are very sensitive to water, and putting water underground can cause micro tremors. People feel like the earth is, you know, creating earthquakes. Water alone, just that one topic, we don't hear about it as much, but it's a big issue when you're in the industry. And if you can't get a permit because you can't, be very clear, here's how I'm handling water, here's how I'm treating the water at disposal, can mean the difference between having a permit to operate and having your permit revoked. And if you have a big oil platform or oil reservoir you're trying to exploit, for which you've paid hundreds of millions of dollars potentially, and you can't exploit it because the local regulator says, no, you're not treating our water resource correctly, you've just basically damaged your entire balance sheet until you can figure this out. So water just is one tiny little risk area, and environmental concern doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a big deal in this industry to figure this one out. And add to this, water has no price. Like, what's the price of water? Most places, water is free. So that doesn't create the right incentive for industry to treat water assets with care. Anyway, that's just one example. And I could go on, because any one of those others I've talked about, land impacts, air impacts, all feature very prominently in some of these kind of risk challenges that the industry has to deal with.
Technically, I mean, tying this a little bit to requirements, because we see definitely like requirements playing like a foundational role to tackle this type of challenges. So
yes.
How would you say teams should pretty much see requirements to tackle those challenges?
Well, the requirements are absolutely critical. There was an interesting story, anecdote, I heard from some colleagues in Australia that one of the major coal seam gas projects was working its way through its waterfall method. And got to the point where they needed to take a major decision around proceeding or not proceeding. And at the very last moment, someone said, hey, how are we handling the wastewater from this facility? And there was no piping. There was no instrumentation. No one was thinking about it through the entire design stage. And this is so you can imagine this, a very significant breakdown. This had to have been a critical requirement at the regulatory stage just to get permits to do anything at all. And yet here we are all the way down to the milestone stage, And this critical resource, water, somehow wasn't factored into the business planning and permitting. It's a millions of dollar miss. There was another example in Alberta about a oil facility forgot, an oil sands plant forgot to provision their settling pond. Now, how do you forget a settling pond? Like, well, this is a breakdown in requirements. Like, the requirements clearly did not work correctly. The whole process was broke. Somewhere was broken all the way through to the end, where you come out and go, "Oi, how did we forget the settling pond?" It's mind-boggling when you think about it. Get to that level. So requirements and requirements tracing is absolutely vital. And we still have lots of examples, even in 2020, where companies get out the other end of a major industrial exercise and discover they forgot something really big, let alone something small. It's one thing to come out and say, "Well, this tank should have had a stairwell put on it, because and how did we miss that?" It's quite another when the entire tank is gone. Like that's a bigger miss, I think. But it unfortunately is still too common in the industry.
And what you think are the reason why those teams basically had those kind of miss on those projects? What's the reason? What's the tips to try to avoid that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I had a nice single, do this one thing. things would be better. I think in this instance, there was a cascading series of challenges. But certainly one of them would have been the absence of appropriate infrastructure, information planning infrastructure in the project. Each of these, requirements flagged, say, at one stage of the project were traced all the way through, and you could see how they were respected and captured and dealt with all the way through to the end. So that infrastructure clearly broke down because it should have caught it. There was, in the case of these projects, there would had to have been an organizational problem. In other words, it's not logical you would come out the other end of a major oil facility that does involve water, only to discover you forgot water in the design. How is that possible? And that really highlights that there was an organizational breakdown. Somewhere in this, how they organized the project, they did not have clear enough accountability for a specific individual or team to be thinking about water all the way through the requirement set. So there's clearly, an organizational issue. And third, other factors, when companies are dealing with, say, multiple contractors, stakeholders, and engineering firms on a major project, each of those firms will bring their own ways of doing work, their own systems, for instance. And sometimes those can be quite incompatible with each other, and things can just fall through the cracks. That's a common problem. And then finally, even where you say take an engineering document, that then has to be handed over to and broken out into its components so the different sub teams can work on their respective elements and pieces of it. Even that infrastructure, is quite fraught because the sheer number of requirements is overwhelming, the number of documents, the number of involved parties, the tight timelines. You add it all up, and you can see why this is such a challenging area to get right. But I see the world typically through a digital hat. I look at that underlying process, and it feels to me like there's a lack of investment in thinking about requirements as a critical piece of the industrial puzzle that companies have to solve.
Can you touch quickly on potentially like the role of the regulators and the impact that they have on those businesses and event like such as this one?
Yeah, it's a good one. I don't know in this instance what the regulators' responsibilities, what their responses may have been, the two examples I've quoted. But I will cast back to an incident in Canada some years ago that illustrates the role of the regulator and how at least in Canadian context, in the U.S. context, the role that they play. So the regulators generally don't like to tell companies how to do something. What they prefer to do is say, this is the outcome I want. as a regulator. How you solve it is up to you, and that lets the free market figure out the lowest cost, most effective way to get it. So if you think about the regulator from that perspective, that's the usual stance. But casting back to the rail disaster, many years ago, there was a cargo of oil coming from one of the Western oil basins on its way to the Canadian East Coast. And it parked overnight in a little town called Lac-Megantic. And the brakes slipped on this rail car, chain of cars. And they then went down the hill and into the town. And in the town, the rail bent around the river at the town. And the rail cars coming down under high speed flipped off the tracks, exploded, and 45, 50 people lost their lives that night. And the regulator immediately said, okay, what rail car were you using? Oh, these were the single walls rail cars. Okay, so in 5 years' time, those cars are and will no longer be permitted on the rail system. So that's the regulator will put the rules down to say, this is now going to be the standard by which we have to follow. And they will, now at that point, now industry has to say for any given standard, be able to demonstrate from start to finish how that standard is being adhered to and monitored. So the regulator plays a critical, critical role. So it's very visible when you have these big incidents, but not as visible the rest of the time. But that's that is their role. There's other examples. There was a pipeline rupture in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few years ago, Enbridge Pipeline. And the oil pipeline, a lot of oil flowed out of the pipeline and polluted the river bay, river area and farmland around there. And the regulators went to the pipeline companies and said, hey, where did this pipe come from? And the pipeline companies were like, ooh, we're not really sure. Well, where else is this particular pipe installed? Because if it failed here in Kalamazoo, maybe it's going to fail in, you know, some other place. And the pipeline company said, we're not sure where we've installed it. There was a whole tracing ability of taking where that pipe came from all the way through to its final use, not tracked correctly. So the regulators then passed two standards that now have to be observed in Canada and the United States to where the materials, the workmanship, the welding, all of that data has to be captured and made available to the regulator if they wish. So that's the role of the regulator. Generally speaking, tends to be reactive and a bit after the fact, sometimes a more ahead of problems when they occur. But they play a very, very key role in making sure, that if you go to sit down with a permitting organization to get your asset commissioned, they're going to walk you through here's was our standards you had to follow. Show us that you followed your standards all the way through. Companies have to be able to respond to those appropriately or their asset won't be accepted.
Yep. It makes total sense. Can we briefly talk about some of the benefits that companies in the industry experience having this standards, certifications, compliances?
Yeah, I mean, the benefits and the upside are really, almost very hard, challenging to put into the bank beforehand because they tend to be contingent as opposed to real. In other words, it's not like you're going to pay out money in advance because of a requirement. But if you haven't followed the requirement all the way through at the very end, and now you can't get your asset commissioned because you can't demonstrate you met and did the compliance, now your asset is on hold. You need to retrofit it. You may have dismissed your crews. Now you got to call them all back. You got to mobilize work. You got to do retrofits and remediations. Extremely costly if by that point. So compliance is low cost, provided you get it done up front in the design level, where you get your requirements in and then you work them through, and exceptionally costly when you don't. So the benefit is measured in things like low or very low remediation costs, lower insurance premiums because you can demonstrate compliance. If you can't demonstrate or prove you've got an issue, when or if you decide to sell those assets, you know, or you wish to go buy assets, if the counterparties can't prove that the asset was built to standard and complies with regulations and you can show the life cycle, you can discount the value of that asset. And this is starting to show up in the carbon world. If somebody wants to buy an asset and it's a carbon emitter, then the value of that asset's going to go down unless the counterparties can show or agree that the carbon levels are lower than expected, or that the mitigations are working, or what have you. So it actually detracts from value. Similarly, if you can demonstrate that your asset was built to the standard, the valuation of it is much higher, or can be higher. So those are where you typically see the, in my mind, you see it. Lower construction costs because of the way you're building it. Lower costs of insurance because you can prove that you're not as great an insurance risk. Better valuation of that asset when and if the time comes for you to monetize it, either by selling it or what have you. And I'm sure there's all kinds of others, but those would be big economic ones that would, you know, really, really be factors, I would think.
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, we personally think like teams probably don't really estimate the impact of having great requirements initially, because they don't see these things and these challenges coming at the end. So it's definitely...
Yeah, and it's very easy. You know, you get onto a project with hundreds of thousands of specific requirements for you to miss 2, 3, a dozen. And you realize you come out the other end going, back to my example, where's the water? I thought you were building me a house that had a plumbing. You forgot the plumbing. These things, you miss them, and it's a crisis at the end. So, yeah, you've got to spend the time and energy up front to get it right.
And especially when, I think, like, when you have, like, a lot of requirements and when you have, like, a lot of modification or change, and it's very, very difficult to track the change and to see, like, I mean, which requirement impact on which one, and the more requirements you have, the more difficult it is to... Basically.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And you see the interface is a critical one. You have say you're constructing an asset and you have a subcomponent which is being manufactured, say, in Malaysia at a big yard. You have another piece of your asset. It's being manufactured in a machine shop in North Dakota. You have a third asset or part of the asset which is being constructed in Texas. They're all going to come together in the Dakotas for construction for your asset construction. And now you have these three things have to interface. You know, they interface with piping, they interface with electrical, they interface on safety, they interface on welds, joints, flanges, all sorts of stuff. And so if the requirements are not real clear all the way through, you could end up bringing these assets together and they don't fit. And it doesn't take much to be out. Like, you're out about by a couple of millimeters and, you know, your flange and mountings won't correctly align. You've got major problems at your site. There was a story a few years ago of one of the oil sands facilities in northern Alberta was being manufactured in Asia. And the design team, one of the requirements had to be, how do you get the module from Malaysia to northern Alberta? It's northern Alberta is not on the ocean. It's not like you float it up to a pier and you move it directly to your facility. You got to put it onto trucks or rail. Well, the design team didn't think through how you bring those big modules on the road system from Canada through the Rockies up to Fort McMurray. So they ended up floating them up one of the major rivers in the northern United States, and then loading them onto trucks and getting them up to Fort Mac, only to discover they were too big for the roads, too big to go around corners, wouldn't go under bridges, too heavy to go over bridges. So all the modules had to be cut up into pieces when they got offloaded, then shipped up to Fort McMurray, and then they had to be rewelded back together to make them to turn them into the asset. Huge cost. Somehow the requirement, no one thought through the logistics. How am I going to get this asset to the site so that it can actually work? And of course, you imagine the teams that are building these assets in Malaysia, had they known that the asset had to fit within a certain air envelope and weight restriction, so it could get under bridges, over bridges, round corners, those assets could have been built in Malaysia to the right size and specification. So very, very expensive when you don't think this stuff through, only discovered at the very end.
Yeah, totally. So I'm not sure if you guys want to add something else. Jeremy, Jeffrey, we're coming to the end of this episode.
Well, it's just from my perspective, there is nothing more important in where we're dealing with things like energy transition, decarbonization, expenditures we're putting into new assets, new energy assets. Those are gas plants, nuclear facilities, solar, wind, and other renewables. Is we need to be building them better. And one of the ways to build them better is to use these innovative tools that do things like let us track requirements and the needs and all the way through the life cycle. And it should no longer be acceptable in society that we build things only to discover after the fact that we forgot about water or pollution or other. That just should no longer be accepted or tolerated. And the solution is to be much more sophisticated in how we think about requirements, getting them right, putting them into our tracking systems and making sure we deal with them totally throughout their entire life cycle. So nothing more important in my mind than this for energy assets, really.
Yeah, I think what I can just add on that, and I will not expand too much, but there are definitely tools in the market that are pretty interesting, because I know, like on our side, Visure, we've been able to deploy and build templates that basically, it's basically like centralized, like all the information, the best practice that we found from different product design in dedicated and specific industries that we put together. And that I think combining those templates, which have those best practice plus interesting capabilities on the tool in terms of traceability, in terms of change management, in terms of the elaboration of the requirement with specific quality and trying to avoid like broad requirement. I mean, there's differently like capabilities that can help to at least like reduce the risk and take and identify the issues ahead of like the development life cycle, I think. And as you say, those are important.
Just one more thing, one more question. Jeffrey, in your opinion, what separates successful projects from unsuccessful ones? This is like our firing last question.
What distinguishes successful from unsuccessful?
Yeah.
Well, the successful ones are hard to see that they're successful until after they are they've been running for a while and they're meeting their performance objective. But the successful ones, in a project sense, are those that meet the owner's ultimate expectation set, which is, was it delivered on time? Was it delivered to produce the quality outcome that I'm paying for? And was it delivered to the budget that I'm after, that I wanted to spend? And was it done safely so that my stakeholders and community are welcoming of my infrastructure into their community? That's how I sort of measure project success. The unsuccessful ones are the ones that obviously don't hit those highlights. They're late, they're over budget, they don't produce what you want, and everybody's upset. Like, to my mind, that's sort of a disaster project. But that's how, you know, a very simple way, that's how I see them. Very, very kind of black and white.
Yeah, we can definitely second to that. So, yeah, where can people find more about you?
Well, if they're looking to track me down, the easiest way is to look me up by name on Google. Jeffrey Can. That will take you to my website where you can people can subscribe to my weekly article series if they're interested in digital topics in oil and gas. My podcast is called Digital Innovations in Oil and Gas, and it's available on iTunes and Amazon and Google and Spotify and Stitcher and YouTube and a host of other places. My two books, the first one is called Bits, Bytes, and Barrels, The Digital Transformation of Oil and Gas. And it sets out the reason why the oil and gas industry needs to embrace digital innovation to its business model for the future. And my latest book was published this year, and it's called Carbon Capital in the Cloud, A Playbook for Digital Transformation. And what it goes through is the how of digital transformation. Who does this well? It features 9 case companies that are doing digital innovations, chock full of good ideas companies can follow to accelerate their digital adoption. And a big emphasis is all about people and change management, because ultimately, embracing digital change is a people problem. It's not a technology problem. So that's how you find me. By name.
Awesome, Jeffrey. Really appreciate it. We'll definitely put your links, to your website and everything on the show notes description, but really appreciate, you sharing your knowledge experiences. Hope to catch up with you anytime soon.
Thank you for inviting me on your podcast today. Appreciate it.